Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens, below the line, with the movers, the shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, editors, film editors, sound mixers, composers, VFX gurus. We talk to everybody. A lot of new content is up on behindthelensonline.net. So check out a lot of that. New reviews. A review for the upcoming Netflix animated film, which is pure enchantment, called The Imaginary. That is coming out on Netflix this Friday. So my review is already up for that. Also on Rotten Tomatoes. And everywhere you find reviews. And a lot of new interview pieces are up there. More going up today when I get home. They're done. But the peepers stopped peeping yesterday. And I my eyes had to close. And I didn't want to take a chance on hitting the publish button until I had a chance to proof everything on a myriad of things. But lots of happening. Dances with Films is coming up in Hollywood at the TCL Chinese Theater Complex. And that starts this week. Very exciting. Today is a Dances with Films Film Festival day here at Behind the Lens. Three filmmakers today. Three calling in live. We're going to have a first for Behind the Lens. We are going to have Xenia LeBlanc and Nicholas Acosta, husband and wife. Nicholas has a film as writer, director, editor, art direction, visual effects, special effects, cinematographer, called The Pickup. That is going to be at Dances with Films on the 25th. His wife, who also stars in Nicholas's short film, The Pickup, his wife, Xenia LeBlanc, also has a short film in Dances with Films that is actually going to screen as part of the Midnight films this coming Saturday at 11:45 at night. And she stars in Nicholas's film, The Pickup. We've had a husband and wife team on before a few times. Jenna St. John and Kevin Good. But they worked on the same project. Now, husband and wife, two different films, made it into the same film festival. So this should be fun. They should be calling in here momentarily. And then at the midpoint of the show, filmmaker, writer, director Stimson Sneed is going to be joining us to talk about his new film, which I'm in love with. I love all three of these films. As I was telling Pam earlier, if LA Film Festival was still happening in Los Angeles, I covered that every year since it started. And every year I released a must-see festival films column on opening day after screening anywhere from 90 to 100% of the films, shorts and features that were going to be in the festival. And I do an overview and then count down, you know, the top ones, the top three, the top 10. Every year it varied. I guarantee you, were I covering Dances with Films or were these films years ago at LA Film Festival? Hey, they would have, all three would have made must see festival films because all three are must sees. I'm excited to talk with Nicholas Xenia and then later on in the show, Stimson. Stimson's film, Time Travel. You science geeks are going to love it. But I can't wait to talk with Stimson about how he created that. But now, first. Okay, are they there, Pam? All right. A big Behind the Lens welcome, too. We've got Xenia LeBlanc and Nicholas Acosta with us. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
So how much competition was there in the household? getting these two films done and submitting them to Dances with Films. That had to
it
be.
It was really fun, but yeah, we tried to help each other out on each other's films.
Thankfully, they weren't at the same time.
True.
I see that. Xenia's film, The Exposed, is at the Midnight Shorts block, block one. Midnight films are always great, be they shorts, be them features. You know you're getting something good in a midnight time block.
And yeah, it's going to be my first time. I'm really excited to be a part of the midnight block.
Oh, my God. You're going to have so much fun, and you get the best audiences at that hour of the night.
Oh, nice.
They're real midnight audiences at film festivals, especially in Hollywood and Dances with Films. I forget which century it's now in, but you get a great crowd. You've got people that may have had a lull from earlier in the night. They've been having some drinks at the bar. They might have been walking around Hollywood Boulevard. They're primed for something good at midnight. And
that's exciting.
And Xenia, I got to tell you, The Exposed, you give something good at midnight. You blew my mind. Blew my mind with this. We got 5 minutes of this film, and I just cannot believe the journey you took us on in 5 minutes. A thriller, twists and turns, total surprise. The cinematography, the color, the ambience is fantastic, but it's what you emotionally packed in within 5 minutes. Wow.
I'm so happy to hear you enjoyed it. I was curious to hear how you felt about did you see it coming? Did you see the end coming?
I did not see that ultimate end coming. You disguised that. So that was a real shocker to me. But, you know,
good.
And as soon as I finished your films, I actually emailed Karen and told her, These would be in my must-see festival films column if I was covering the whole festival for DWF, because these are fantastic. But it's what you do.
Thank you so much.
And I personally would like to see a feature. I would like to see The Exposed expanded into a feature.
That would be great. Maybe, absolutely. It's just a starting point.
Yeah.
But that would be great.
Just absolutely wonderful. And it's a simple story. A nurse comes home after work. She's tired, dead on her feet. She wants a cup of tea or to make dinner. Sits down to rest and hears things. Of course, if I heard somebody at my door and it was pitch dark out there, I would not open the door to look. But it's a simple setup. I mean, it's great, but your visual tonal bandwidth in 5 minutes speaks volumes, Xenia. So tell me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're ignoring Nick here, but we're going to finish with you first, and then we'll let Nick talk.
I'm lonely over here.
Oh, Nick. Oh, I'm so sorry. But you're going to hear a lot of good stuff, too. What was the genesis? What was the impetus for The Exposed, the premise, and how you developed this story so quickly within five minutes?
So ultimately that was a contest. It was a contest, a short horror contest that I made this film for originally. It was hosted by Jacob Owens. He makes a horror contest every year, and there are specific rules you have to follow to make your story. So in this case, we had to tell a story in no more than 5 minutes. It could be less than 5 minutes. And it had to, in some creative way, incorporate a mask, not use any CGI or visual effects, and not use any, crazy equipment like the Steadicams or, anything over the top, only the tripod, handheld, and basically going back to basics with filmmaking. One of the other things we had to use in the film was we had to incorporate a frame from a famous horror film. So in this case, if you remember the film, there is a frame there that kind of imitates the frame from Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that was one of the moments. I'm not going to disclose it so it doesn't ruin the film for those who are about to watch it. But so ultimately I was really excited about it because I very much wanted to create a story without you using visual effects or just to tell a good story within 5 minutes and also make it somewhat different, something that plays against your expectations of what you think the story is going to be like. So I just sat down and I thought of all kind of characters that I kind of personally find interesting, or somebody who, like in this case, that this was a nurse and she was very tired. What kind of tricks can be played with this kind of characters and this kind of mindset. And so the story was born. And then, I don't want to talk too much about the mask. So it doesn't, reveal anything. But that was basically, this was the inspiration, I think, for the story.
And I love the fact, and this is a perfect example of how you get creative and how you can make a quality film, albeit a short film, but make a quality film with practical equipment, practical work.
Exactly.
In camera.
Yes.
That's, you don't need the CGI. You don't need $300
exactly.
million dollars to make a film that's good. And, you put your mind to work. You figured out how to do it. And that really is one of the beauties of this, is the creativity.
Absolutely. Like, for example, the phone call mm-hmm. that she has with her friend.
Yep.
We had to have her friend be downstairs, and she was on the phone with us live, and we were communicating with her. So everything was filmed live instead of using visual effects, which would have been easier, but not as exciting.
Yeah, I mean, just so well done, Xenia. So well done.
Thank you.
I can't wait to hear how the audience, responds to this. I really think that they're going to like it. I think you're going to get a lot of gasps. There's going to be gasping.
I'm excited to see it with a live audience as well.
And it's the world premiere. So there has not been a live audience seeing this.
No, not at all.
Well, wow. I love it. I love it.
Thank you. I'm super excited. I really am excited to see it along with other people, in a big theater, because that's always different. That's not the same as putting your film out there and, online or nowadays everything is streaming. It's a completely different energy. So I'm really excited to see how people will react to it and, see other films as well in that same block.
And to be at the Chinese Theater Complex for your world premiere, that's special. That's special. You may not be in the big Chinese theater, but the fact that you're part of it, that does
yes.
make it special.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very excited about that.
But you have a second reason to be excited, because you are the star. Now it's going to be your turn, Nicholas.
He's ready.
You are the star in your husband's short film. Much longer than 5 minutes, though, people. So, your short film, Nicholas, The Pickup. Talk about
yes.
a fun, action-packed, coming out on the heels of all the stunt wonders that everybody has now been privy to, thanks to The Fall Guy. Now, we see stunts, action with Xenia.
Yep.
I got to ask you first, Nicholas. How well did she
yes.
How well did she take direction from you in The Pickup?
For my safety, I cannot really disclose that right now.
Okay, well that tells me all I need to know.
No. all jokes aside, no. We've worked with each other for quite some time over the past 4 or 5 years now.
Six.
Oh my god.
And, now, that's what's going to get you in trouble. You didn't remember the six.
Yeah. Exactly.
No.
But like we've been kind of working with each other, and one thing which, you know, we started shooting this, but I think before we were married. Yeah, we started shooting before we weren't
not
even.
This, though, the other song.
No, we were shooting. Yeah, we were.
Oh, you're
it
right.
Took some time. We started shooting this during the pandemic, so because of that, we weren't married yet, and you know, so we had kind of learned this sense of communication of how to work and collaborate, including with even on her film, you know, understanding when, especially you got two directors, two creatives, like when to step aside and when to also kind of take someone's input and things like that. So working with her has always been fun. You know, she's the one, kind of person who will like listen, but at the same time tell me like, hey, I got this, you know, or I think I got this figured out, or
we can do it in a simpler way.
Yeah, or find a way to do it simpler. But yeah, no, it's always wonderful to work with her.
Likewise.
Well, this is Xenia plays a CIA agent or some government agent, and she has a delivery to make. But she doesn't make arrangements for transport or the logistics. You got a whole team in the office that does that. But I got to question this team when they make arrangements for the driver to drive Alpha, which is Xenia's name. They make arrangements for an Uber driver named Joe to pick her up and drive her for this sensitive drop off, which is funny enough in and of itself. And fueling that funny is also the wonderful Sam Puefua, who plays Delta. Puefua, okay, who plays Delta, the CIA boss, who has this mystified look on his face looking at his team. Who called Uber? Who called Uber? So that's
my favorite moment.
That sets up comedy right there. But then you put Xenia together with Joe, your Uber driver, beautifully played by Adam MacArthur. And you've got a contained environment for those two in a car. And it turns into a chase scene through the streets of Los Angeles. Guns a-blazing. Cars colliding. All kinds of, you know, crunching metal and things flying through the air. It is hilarious. I found it hilarious, but so much fun. You don't take a breath while you're watching this because you keep the pedal to the metal with the action in the way you've cut this. Just, I love it, Nicholas. I love it.
Thanks. That was very much the intention, like, while we were making this thing. My goal was literally, like, let's make a Michael Bay movie on a budget. At the same time, we were also we were trying effects and experimenting with these techniques that we've never done before. So that's why we ended up making, I wrote it as a comedy instead of like a straight up action film, because the way I saw it is like, okay, if these effects don't work, we'll just embrace the comedy and say like, oh yeah, it was meant to be bad. But they ended up kind of working, which made it even funnier, and then made it even better because of the production value of the film looks bigger than what it should be, and also what it should be considering the budget that it was made for, which a lot of people are always just shocked by.
Well, you're not telling it on this show, that's for sure. I don't let budget amounts be revealed. Well, you don't want the budget price to get out there, because distributors, people do pick up short films, just like with features. You don't want to undercut yourself if they find out, oh, he only spent $2,000, so we can buy this for $10,000. You never want to undercut yourself that way. So
True. But I feel like in situations like this, it's something that this is a selling point on the fact, like, wow,
this is what Nick can do.
Aren't able to accomplish this. We used very little CGI and actually used more
practical,
like with miniatures and toys. You know, like you said, like, you know, metal crashing, guns and everything, all that stuff. But we actually did this in L.A., even though with no permits, we did it as safely as possible. We followed all the rules of the road. We look like we're going faster than we were going when we weren't actually driving at that fast. Mm-hmm. We made sure that all safety was the key. It was number one goal every time we were shooting. And actually, we were very lucky in a couple times where we got LAPD, like, saw us, and they were like, what are you doing? We're like, oh, we're making a, you know, the classic, the student film. And they were like, cool, can we watch? Can we help? And they,
be a part of it?
And they actually helped us a couple times. And it was, you know, it was kind of off the books, but at the same time, it was one of those things where it's like, wow, like
they were excited.
We're doing something that is literally going to be something that everyone's going to be like, no way.
Well, and you know, they didn't have anything better to do during the pandemic. The streets are empty.
Exactly.
There are no tickets to write. There are no cars to pursue. No chases. So, you know, of course. Why not
empty
help?
Road. That's why we were shooting.
That's it. Why not help out a filmmaker? Now, you are wearing so many hats making this film, The Pickup, Nicholas.
Yeah.
Writer, director, cinematographer, editor, art direction, visual effects, the few special effects you have. Is this...
Hairstylist.
Hairstylist. Okay. Well, you know, I've got to ask you. How difficult or challenging is it for you to wear all of those hats when making a project?
It can be very, it can be very kind of, you know, overwhelming sometimes. You know, there's moments like, well, first off, Xenia was also my producer on it, so she really helps like organize. There was days where I was like, I don't know. And she'd be like, okay, here. And she got a like, you know, piece of paper, a huge piece of paper, and we're like drawing out like, this is what we need. These are the dates. This is what, and she like helped me just break down that stuff. But what we did was, I'm the kind of person who comes in prepared. I really like to think about every single detail. So what we did was we created like what we call rip-a-matic, basically, or an animatic.
Okay.
Basically, we just like cut scenes from other movies together, intercut with shots from a parked car shoot with Xenia and Adam, mm-hmm. where we're literally just in my parked car in our driveway, just being like, okay, act out this sequence, and okay, you say this, and like that, shooting on my phone, and then I intercut that with other movies that had action sequence like moments,
okay.
after we had written the script and knowing what I'm capable of, and then I just cut it together, and anything I didn't have, I would just write as text, like, you know, shot from rear view mirror or looks over mm-hmm. shoulder, and just to kind of like figure out the timing, figure out what we needed. And then on the day, we basically just shot it as we went. Mm. You know, it's like, okay, a visual storyboard, like a moving storyboard. And we were able just to look at the video, be like, okay, this is the shot we need to do next. So that helped with the organization. But it was one of those things where it's like, okay, I am the director, but I also am the cinematographer and the camera op. And that was due to necessity because, again, pandemic. We were only started shooting when people started getting vaccinated. So mm-hmm. it was a situation where we felt safe to kind of get some people together, particularly the friends that we invited were people who were early vaccinators or vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Some were actually, you know, like firefighters or working with like firefighter unit or with what was it, the service that was doing it. He was working at, you know, Dodger Stadium. So a lot of them were like were working that, so they were already safe because of that. And so with that, I was trying to organize everybody and everything. And, you know, we were trying to keep it on budget. And we started shooting this when I was already unemployed after 12 months or 13 months. And then thankfully, my job called me back. And so we were able to start up. And that means we were able to put more funds into the production. But also it meant that we had to kind of take our time shooting because we were going to shoot it over the course of like 2-3 months. And then it became a situation like, oh, okay. We're going to have to postpone this over weekends and figure it out. But yeah, it was kind of, there was days where I was literally like, what am I doing? It's like all this stuff I have to do in one day, but we just took it one shot at a time and one scene at a time sometimes.
Well, something that I really appreciate that you did is you gave us the full interior of the car of, you know, of Joe's Uber vehicle. We get the front seat, we get the back seat. You're giving us different angles in there, so it's not stale. You keep it as energized and kinetic as the car chase that's happening on the street. And I really, I love that you did that. You didn't just give a traditional front seat, back seat, front seat, back seat. No, you changed things up and kept it moving inside the car, just like outside the car. And that really works.
Yeah, I think that's what, like, the animatic would really help with, kind of. We wanted to create something interesting because we had this animatic, we edited the film. We basically had a rough edit of the film before we even shot the film. We kind of could see. I literally, like we said, we would sit in the car with Senya and Adam on the day, and we just sat down in the car, parked, and I just shot with my camera, being like, okay, you say that line, I say this line. And by figuring out, we were getting all these different angles. And then I was able to cut it up together after to see, does this work? And also, because we were shooting over the course of many months, I would eventually also get to see, like, okay, I was basically puzzle piecing these new shots into the already edited film of, you know, the animatic. But as I was putting it together, I could see, like, hey, we're missing something here. Even towards the end, when this big stunt, the big crescendo action sequence, we're like, you know, I want to see what's going on with the bad guys in the car. Mm-hmm. Let's have this whole extra scene in there. And that was basically because we had took our time to put it together, and also making sure that I didn't want to keep it stale, as you were saying. Like, I have a very, like, kinetic kind of energy of, like, editing and filmmaking. I'm an editor by day at the CW, cutting, like, promos for, like, trailers and for their shows. So I really understand about, you know, like, you know, get people's entertainment and energy. But yeah, it was really kind of fun to kind of, like, see it come together from these, like, small, like, you know, rough edits to this huge, like, well shot, you know, well lit sound designed moments, you know.
It is on every level, Nick. It is impeccably done.
I couldn't have done it without Xenia.
Well, I love the footage of Xenia leaning out of car windows, firing at the oncoming bad guys.
Oh, God, that was so tough.
Wind whipping through her hair. That was so much fun watching that.
That was the one thing that I remember when I was, like, writing this. I'm like, that's gonna be so cool. Xenia, your head's gonna stick out the car. The wind is gonna blow. The car is gonna fly over while you're doing it. I was just like, this has got to be so cool, and I wanted it to be
really
that. It was really cool just to see these visuals that you see in big Hollywood blockbuster movies being done with my wife, and being, yeah, that's my wife. That's my, don't mess with us.
Yeah, well, don't mess up the shot either when it's your wife hanging out the car window. Just both of your films, just so well done. I love them both. If I had to choose between both for an audience award, I couldn't do it. I would not be able to do it. Now, I've got to ask about the film festival. Who had to do the paperwork? Did you each do your own to submit to the festival?
Yep.
Yeah, we basically, again, she produced mine. And, you know, I would get her, I would ask her advice on certain things. But on her film, though, I'm kind of like a co-associate producer. She did that one mainly by herself because I was actually at work when she was shooting the Jacob Owens one. Mm-hmm. So I just came by. I came home one day and, like, there's a whole crew, which I knew. But, like, I come home and I'm like, after a long day and being like, okay, how can I help now? I'm sorry you guys are already done, but how can I help? But yeah, we
submitted our own, each our own film.
Now, who heard first about getting into the festival?
Nick.
Yeah, it was me, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Yeah, me.
And how long after you heard did you hear, Xenia, that you got into it?
About a week or so.
Were you biting your fingernails? Were you hissing it,
I'll
Nick?
I'll tell you why also.
Because
originally I heard about Dances with Films before the pandemic, and I submitted my series to Dances with Films. They were a comedy, female-driven comedy series, and I got in, and then the pandemic happened, and I never got to go to the festival. I mean, they did the virtual screening, but it was a completely different feeling.
It's not the same.
So I was...
It's not the same.
Yeah, it was really, we did like a Zoom red carpet, which was something ridiculous, fun, but ridiculous. But so I was really excited to submit again, and I was hoping to get in because I really wanted to be a part of the experience, you know, the live experience.
Well, now the two of you will be able to experience it. The pickup, Tuesday, June 25th, as part of the Fusion Shorts Block 2 at 5:00. and Xenia the Exposed. You screen first. Okay, so I'm just pointing that out. Your film is going to screen before Nick's film.
Yep.
So
we get it. She's better.
No, you know. What she has done with 5 minutes, granted yours is just a couple minutes longer, but it's something about the midnight creepy vibe that makes things maybe a little more sparkly. I don't know. But The Exposed will be Saturday the 22nd at 11:45 at night as part of the Midnight Shorts Block 1. Guys, sadly, I have to let you go so that I can have another Dances with Film filmmaker join me, who has a film in the festival as well. This has been so much fun having you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to see features of these shorts expanded into features. I really do, both of them.
That'd be great.
They are that good.
Looking for financiers. Anyone out there, you know, let us know.
You know, pitch that. It Dances with Films. There will be people at Dances with Films that you can engage. That's one of the big things about film festivals. You got them there to engage with them. Engage. Yeah. And say, look what I can do. Look what I can do for you. This is what I want to do. Finance me. Guys, an absolute joy. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful time at the festival. And I'm rooting for some audience awards for you at the very least.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Nicholas. Thank you, Xenia. You have a great rest of your week and a great kickoff to DWF this weekend.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Nicholas Acosta and Xenia LeBlanc talking about their films, The Pickup and the Exposed, at Dances with Films. Now, The man I've been waiting to talk to, Stimson Sneed. Stimson, how are you?
Well, feeling a little shy right now. That last film sounded really good.
both of those short films.
Really,
and actually your film, Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox, it is going to screen on the 25th. At 9:15 p.m., so you're going to screen after Nick's short film, The Pickup, screens in the in the Fusion Shorts block that starts at 5:00. So yeah, so you'll all be bouncing around there.
Yeah, I got to say I've been hitting up a lot of festivals the last couple months because this is my first feature, which is a lot of fun with all the extra treatment they give you when you're a feature director.
Uh-huh.
But all the blocks I go to are other short films.
Yeah.
Because it's like, these are my people, this is my safe space, and there's just so much invention and creativity there. When I'm at festivals, it's going to be the short film blocks that I go to see on my own time.
That's one of the great things about festivals. It's something that I have always loved. And if I happen to pop in to DWF at all, it will be to see the short film blocks, because especially as what Xenia did with her short, The Exposed, it's all practical. There's no special effects. There's no steady cams. There's no rigging. There's nothing. It's either handheld or on a tripod. You got basic lights and you got to come up with something. And it really, short films really have the bigger potential to show creativity, because short films inevitably have a lot less money than even the low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget feature films at festival level. And that's where I really just love to see what filmmakers can come up with as storytellers and not just gluing things together. You know, here's a frame, here's a frame, here's a frame, but actually a cohesive, cogent story and really bring it to fruition. So I'm right there with you on shorts blocks, but boy, oh boy, everybody, this is an absolute must-see festival film. Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox You blew my mind with this one. You blew my mind, Stimson.
Oh, thank you.
I love time travel movies. My problem with most time travel movies, with the exception maybe Primer, which was a festival film for LA Film Festival many years ago. Most of them, even Safety Not Guaranteed, it ended up with a metaphor and romance and finding something better than humanity. They get too bogged down in the metaphoric aspect of, oh, we can change this, and oh, wouldn't it be wonderful? You go straight for the science, and you posit everything out of, well, what happens if I do this? Okay, well, what happens if I do this? Well, why am I still standing here? Because I just killed me, but I'm still here. And you really give us these great questions.
Oh, thank you.
Through the entire film. And you do it thanks to an incredible, incredible leading man, Samuel Dunning, who plays Tim Travers. And you could have 21 Tim Travers standing there on set in one scene, and I am not disappointed. Let me just say that. He is so good.
It was a lot of work pulling that off.
So this is the big thing here. Now, the premise, it's a great premise. Scientist creates a time machine, kills his younger self. So now it bodes a scientific and existential question. How come I'm still standing here if I just killed myself? And then let's try it again. How am I still standing here when I just killed my prior self and my prior self? And how can I still be standing here when I kill my prior self, my prior self, my prior self, and the prior self? And this keeps going. So you set up this incredible paradox that just drags you into a black hole within your mind. Yes.
I love your word choice there.
But it is so engaging. And it just makes you think. But at the same time, it is so entertaining, Stimson, especially with the variances within each of the Tim Travers characters that pop up. There's something slightly different with each iteration. And that is just brilliant. It is brilliant.
As I say, you blew my mind. Well, the thing about that premise is it's not an original premise. In the film, we refer to it as the grandfather's paradox, and we describe it as a thought experiment. That's a real thought experiment, and it's been around basically since people started talking about time travel and actually getting into the science of it. I mean, that's part of the joy of this film is we want to take these real questions like the grandfather's paradox and actually explore the consequences of that and go a lot deeper than simply using it as plot hole, which is usually as far as it normally gets. But the grandfather's paradox, I mean, that is a old time theory, and there's several different versions of it that's used as thought experiments.
Yeah, and I've heard that before, but I haven't seen people implement it in a film. You know, you implement it and you do it so beautifully. Talk to me about crafting this script, staying within the ideas and the principles of the grandfather's paradox, and crafting this character of Tim. Because if Tim doesn't work, nothing's going to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can say out the gate, because we had already done the short film with Samuel Dunning.
Mm-hmm.
And if Sam had not been around to do the feature, there would have been no feature.
Yeah, I can see that.
He's just indispensable in that role. We came at this from a very strange writing perspective, because this is what I like to call a spare parts movie. It was a script that had to come together lightning fast from the time we decided to even make Tim Travers into a feature.
Mm-hmm.
And by we, I'm just talking about myself, Samuel Dunning, Rich Cowan, one of the executive producers, to when we rolled camera, was only 90 days. Like, we started writing the first draft of the script 90 days before we rolled camera. And one of the things we had to do budget-wise was me kind of reusing sets and props and other things I could get my hands on the cheap that looked expensive so I could up the quality of the film. And then I kind of built the story outward from that. The way the science always has worked in the film was there's a lot of really interesting actual theory behind time travel, which unfortunately has the really depressing spoiler that what all those theories show is that time travel is impossible. That said, the reasons why it's impossible are really interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's what we explored a lot of in the short. So when I was putting together this script at just this crazy speed, we had to put it together, it was me taking those ideas that we had already had time to really firmly establish in the short, and then digging into, for lack of a better word, the cut content. Because when I was doing the research for the short, there were so many other ideas I came across that in a 20-minute film, I just didn't have time to explore. And then the other part of that is finding the balance character-wise. You brought this up when you were introducing the film. So many films use time travel and stuff like that basically as an excuse for metaphor. It's not time travel, it's time magic.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to really avoid with this. But so we kept that stuff to about one half of the script. The other half of the script is really digging into the Tim Travers character in a way that we did not do in the short film. In the short, he's very much a one-joke character, and so for the feature, I wanted to find a way to let him expand out into something personal, something that, under all the science, there is something real and emotional to connect with. But at the end of the day, writing-wise, it really just comes back to being a spare parts movie. We were under the gun, and it was just a lot of very skilled people working together, bouncing ideas off of each other to see what we could do that made sense, that stayed true to the ideas we wanted to explore, as fast as we possibly could do it. Joel McHale's character, James Boone Ratty, podcaster. I mean, we wrote that character for exactly two reasons. One, there was a different film that had gotten canceled that had Joel McHale in it, and I still wanted to work with Joel. And two, I was able to get a radio station set for Next to Free, so I needed to use that radio station set. I mean, it was that Machiavellian. It was, here's a radio station. Well, got to use it.
That's it.
How do I use this?
Well, you know, and this is, you are a perfect example of why with so many directors who write and direct their own material, I often ask them, you know, it's like, while you were writing, were you drawing little diagrams? Were you coming up with your visuals? Many directors are not thinking about the visual. Many writers, writer-directors are not thinking about the visuals that they're going to create once they've stopped typing and writing on the page. Your approach, the words are not on the page unless you have the visuals, some semblance of them, based on what you can find and pull together. And I love
film
that.
Film is a visual medium.
Yes.
For me, before I was a director, I've always been a director by goal. But for years and years, I paid my bills as a director of photography. So constructing the visuals, even when I had no authority over actors or dialogue, was part of how I just paid my rent for a long time. The good news is the technology on that side has advanced so fast that I would be an utterly worthless DP now. But now that I am directing bigger stuff, I get to get much more talented people to work with me. Our director of photography was Brian Gosling, who also worked on the short film and another short film of mine called Lab Rats. So we already had a really cleanly established dynamic. Brian really knows how I like to shoot on set. Brian, in addition to being a great DP, is a world-class gaffer who we partnered with an even more experienced gaffer than him, Vukas. And they were able to move through these visuals at a, frankly, just gangbuster speed on set to get the stuff in. But there's a way that I like shooting, and Brian understands that. And I do build my visuals a lot over what I can get my hands on. I'm a firm believer that every penny available goes on the screen. If you're spending money, you should be able to see the money right out there.
Absolutely.
I want people to see the quality.
And
to not be so precious about our darlings that when something cooler presents itself on set, we're not so married to the original version to go, well, that's better. I apologize, I interrupted, but one of the things that happened on set was we had this huge fog roll in when we were outdoors,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of discussion about how to shoot to avoid the fog, but we decided not to because it looked so cool and it was right there, so let's embrace it.
Mm-hmm. And I know the scene that you're talking, I know where the fog is.
Thank you.
And it works beautifully. You know, that's one of those serendipitous things, but, you know, you are gutsy enough and smart enough that you know, hey, this is going to add another element to the film, and this is going to be great, and you made it great, and I can't, the work that Brian has done is, I love the visual tonal bandwidth, I love how that tonal bandwidth shifts, depending on at what point we are in the movie, particularly when we get to the third act, and we have a lot of visual tonal shifts in that third act. But it's, But it's done seamlessly. Brian's work is gorgeous. Whoever your colorist is did an amazing job. But
phenomenal. It's some of his best work, Rendell.
Oh, my God. Well, what this does is it showcases all those things that you were scrapping together, scurrying around to find, and what your production designer Vincent DeFelice did. I gotta tell you,
oh my god, yeah,
that lab,
that time machine, he had to build it twice.
I love it.
Machine, he nearly killed himself when he made the short film building that time machine in only 2.5 weeks, and I remember calling him a year later to say, hey, we're doing a feature, you remember that prop that nearly killed you? I need you to build it a second time, but even better.
I think
I
that
swear
is
the man
so
tried
cool.
to order a strike on me.
I,
sorry, not a union strike. I mean like a military
airstrike. A military airstrike.
Yeah.
If we're traveling through time, perhaps that could happen. Be careful. Be careful.
Yeah.
Maybe Vincent figured out how to time travel. That could have been a real strike.
Hey, he built that machine, and it's a phenomenal prop. It is 24 feet tall.
Wow.
And it actually dictated a lot of how we would shoot the film. So going back to Brian Gosling and the work he did, even the scenes not with the time machine all still need to be visually of a piece,
mm-hmm.
so that it all feels part of the same film.
Right.
And one of the first things we decided is the film's got to be 16 by 9 because we know we're going to have all these scenes where you have a dozen Tims on screen simultaneously,
yep.
with split screen. So we just needed the space side to side. But because we're shooting 16 by 9 and the time machine's so tall, we kept losing the top of the time machine. So the whole film is shot in between 18 and 24 millimeters, which is just a ridiculously wide-angle lens to shoot a low-budget film on.
Wow.
Like this, to the point where it became a running joke on set where Brian would walk and go, so we could do the 32 or the 18, and he would pause without me even answering and go with a laugh, it's going to be the 18, right?
I mean, the time machine I love, and actually when I first saw it, it reminds me of some of the early illustrations in Madeline L'Engle's classic, A Wrinkle in Time. Much reminds me of Camazotz and what they find there.
Oh, yeah. And I love that early art style of old book cover science fiction. I am a deep love of that art style. And
yes.
That very much influences the look of the film. I love B sci-fi that takes itself seriously. I mean, right down to the title. The title is a nod to that old pulp fiction, Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
And your one sheet looks like it was lifted right out of the days of Flash Gordon serials.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just, or Forbidden Planet, or, you know, something fun like that. You have so many great cinematic nods, artistic nods in here with your look, with the production design. Just absolutely amazing. But it all is cohesive. That's the great thing that you have also done here, Stimson. Everything is cohesive. Nothing feels out of place or that it doesn't belong.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It all feels...
Even my own performance, I play a supporting role and helps her.
We won't talk about that one, but I do want to know, how well did actor Stimson take direction from director Stimson?
Well, I got to say, actor Stimson is an utter pill to work with.
Mm.
One, he never read his lines, constantly off, not off book. Massive diva about the whole thing. He seems very distracted, like he was focusing on other stuff, like directing a movie. Every time I was on camera, I was kind of mentally blacking out. Playing Helter is a lot of fun because he's a fun supporting character, but that is very much a time where I am leaning very heavily on the other creatives around me. I'm trying to feed off of Sam's energy because I'm on screen with him typically, and I'm putting a lot of trust and faith into my director of photography and my first AD, Cheyenne, to guide me and give me feedback and honest feedback.
Oh, my God. Now, because we have at one point, how many is it, 12, 15, 21, Tim Travers.
I think the highest we ever get in a single shot happens about 30 minutes into the film, and I think it's just around 26.
Yeah, I'm like counting, and I'm trying to count. And I didn't stop the film. Now, I will go back and watch it again, and I will actually count and see how many there were. But how much of a challenge was that for you in the editing process? Layering
in. Well, it was
in...
easy for me because I had someone else do it.
Oh, well.
Our editor was a gentleman named Jason McKee, who is also the special effects coordinator. He runs the company ModeFX that did all the effect shots to it. And having editorial and post effects overseen by the same guy really had a lot to do with the effects being so successful in this film, because even as he's editing it, he already knows how he's going to do the effect, so he can just focus on the edit. And this film has over 540 effect shots in it.
Wow.
Yeah, over 540.
Wow.
It's just ridiculous. But no, Jason McKee oversaw a lot of that. Now, we did do a lot of tricks to make it easier.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our multiple Tim shots are not actually multiple Tims. We have body doubles and lookalikes, including at least two lookalikes who are such dead ringers for Samuel Denning that their faces actually make it on screen at the edges of the frame without any effects. It's just a different actor who looks like Sam. And we also used another actor by the name of David Babbitt, who also plays the role of Tim Travers. Like, he's actually completely off book. He's delivering lines. We can even hear his voice once or twice in the film. And that's giving Sam someone to be giving a real performance to react to, as well as someone that he can physically interact with. Mm-hmm. So all the scenes in which Sam touches himself, and I won't go into details as to what I'm referring to, but you know what I'm referring to.
I know.
That's David Babbitt
doing
all that work. And we actually give David a cameo because, unlike the other body doubles, all great guys, by the way, but they're doing mostly body double work, Babbitt is doing such a real performance that we actually cameo him in the film in a completely different role. So the delivery boy that you see a couple times in the film, that's the other Tim Travers.
Which is why it makes perfect sense, because he has a great resemblance to Sam. But that also explains...
Oh, so much so we had to make him look less like Sam on camera.
Yeah, you had the hats on. It's, you know, you did a great job with that poor coffee delivery guy. which also begs the question, how much coffee do 26 Tims drink?
I don't know, but I know on that film set, we went through a lot of coffee, and my heart nearly exploded because I think I was on 4 to 5 Red Bulls a day in the course of production.
Oh, my God. Stimson.
Oh. Hey, this film was shot in only 17 days, so we were huffing it.
It just amazes me. Now, you know, Sam, he is Tim Travers. He is this film, but he's got to have real people, more than just poor David, who, by the way, I love what you do with the end credits. and the Tim Travers, and you're wiping out names, and David stays up there. So I love that. That was a really cool.
We had to give a nod to David. He
did
some incredible work on this, and unfortunately, we're using effects to hide his face. We're hiding his work the entire film.
Yeah. But he gets a credit. He gets an on-screen credit. But I thought that was so clever the way you did that with the end credits. And, of course, the Easter egg that we have at the midpoint of the end credits. Your opening titles are wonderful. I love how you're going through the whole Tim Travers plant with your opening titles. But, you know, in addition to having, okay, so he gets David or Body Devils to play off of, but he's got to have some real people there. And boy, oh boy, did you give him real people. Besides Joel McHale as James Bunratty, you give him Felicia Day as Delilah, who is Bunratty's, I'd say, producer, podcast producer.
Mm-hmm.
Then you give us a brilliant turn by Danny Trejo and Keith David, who...
Keith David in a role that we are not allowed to describe the context of.
No, absolutely not. That is... It is just beyond impressive, beyond... It is everything.
Also, just extraordinarily nice people to work with. Felicia is actually one of the executive producers on the film. In addition to playing the role of Delilah, she has been one of the leads behind a lot of the post-production and distribution that we've been working on, and also just helping to promote the film. She has been a wonderful person to collaborate with, and also someone who I've just personally been a fan of for years. So it was a great pleasure having her on set, along with Joel, Keith, and Danny.
Well... And another actor that you have that makes an indelible impression is Nicole Murray as a bartender.
She is
so fun, Stimson. So fun. And that poor girl, I don't know how many hours of makeup you had her endure.
I don't know what it is about poor Nicole Murray, but everything I've seen her in, every time I've worked with her... Just circumstances always seem to conspire that she is going to get drenched in gore at some point. Like, I don't know if people have a face for gore, but for whatever reason, Nicole just has a face for gore. I don't know how this keeps happening to her.
I swear
it is not a deliberate thing. It just keeps happening.
Her performance is indelible. It is unforgettable. I had so much fun watching her.
Well, the great fun of Nicole in the film is when we were casting, because of how truncated the timeline was on this film, in some cases, we were casting the celebrities after we'd already started shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we didn't get Keith David confirmed until less than 3 days before he was on set. So, in the case of all of our big leads, we actually had understudies. And any time we were able to get a celebrity in there, I would still cast the understudy in another role to reward them for the work they had done and as an excuse to give them a great paycheck. Nicole Murray was actually Felicia Day's understudy.
Mm-hmm.
So she would have stepped into the Delilah role had I not been able to get Felicia for the role. I was very lucky. I got Felicia, and I also got to put Nicole in a great role in the film as well as the bartender.
Now, how much of Nicole's scenes in the bar... In the third act, how many of what we see is practical effects and makeup, and how much?
Oh, completely practical.
You did all of that practically.
Other than the thing that causes her to get covered in blood,
right?
Which I can't describe.
No, we cannot
describe.
Other
than that specific shot, which is CG, everything else after that is completely practical.
Wow. Because I just love it. The detail. And the way, and what's so cool is the way Brian brings the camera down and we're eye level with the bar and we're seeing certain things that are on the bar after these events are unfolding. And I love that POV that Brian gives us with all of the practical accoutrement, shall we say. Without... I'm trying to come up with a clever word. That's the cleverest one I come up with without revealing.
And a wonderful use of jam as a practical prop element.
Is that what you used?
Yeah, when that very first thing that Nicole has an experience with, shall we say, is jam.
Oh, my God. I never would have suspected. Never would have suspected that was what was used.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to ask an actor to, how to phrase this, interact intimately with something, the least you can do is make sure it can be a pleasant experience for them.
That's so considerate of you, Stimson.
I try. You know, I try. I went to the student film Days of My Life and the short film Early 20s, which are all just one big series of how can a group of friends repeatedly hurt each other.
Yeah.
And now that I'm well into my 30s, I try to actually make life good for my actors.
Well,
in fact, one of my longtime friends who has been in all of my films going all the way back to student film days cameos in the film briefly. And I have inflicted countless acts of bodily harm against this poor man back in our 20s. The guy who plays the homeless man outside the bar is my oldest friend in the world, Alex Wolf, who actually designed several of the props for the film. So that was our way of cameoing him.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Still friends, in spite of the fact that I have done some truly horrible things to that man.
Yeah, I mean, not only does he still speak to you, but your friends. You know, that speaks volumes about that man. Volumes.
Oh, yeah. Yes, what it speaks is that he has very poor judgment.
Oh. Now, I know we've been tantalizing everybody, tiptoeing around so many of the elements of Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox, which means they're going to have to go to Dances with Films on Tuesday night at 9:15, Tuesday the 25th, next Tuesday, to see the film at Dances with Films. But this begs the question for me is, what led you to Dances with Films? What made you think or that Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox would be a good fit for DWF?
Yeah, I feel so bad saying this, but honestly, the decision is very business. Dances with Films is just undisputably one of the best genre film festivals in Los Angeles, and if we're going to do our Los Angeles premiere, we have to make sure we're with a really good festival, and that's Dances with Films. I've always enjoyed the festival myself, and I've always enjoyed their content, but really, the decision-making is selfish. People should come out and see the film, not just my film, but all the other films at the festival, because Dances is where you're going to get some of the best stuff to premiere in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So I just, audiences in general, make it out to Dances, even if you can't make it to my film, although do make it to my film.
Well, you know, it's like, I want people to see your film. I want people to see Nick Acosta's film, The Pickup. I want them to see Xenia LeBlanc's film, The Exposed. And I've seen a few others. I've seen four other DWF films so far. I got two more that I'm looking at. And another DWF filmmaker will be here next week. But yes, also
later in the festival, you need to check out Death Perception, which stars your favorite, Nicole Murray, which premieres a few days after we do.
Oh, well, now I'm going to have to hunt down the publicist for that film. Hopefully a publicist has that film. This is another element.
Say hi for me.
This is another element of of film festivals that you, Nick, Xenia, and a few other people have been smart enough to do. You hired a publicist for the festival level. This is so important when it comes to getting the word out about independent film, festival-level films, filmmakers, publicists only help you at this stage of the game.
Oh, absolutely. And also, so a big shout-out to our publicist, Karen Oberman. I can hear the argument for why some people don't do the publicist for short films, because as much as I love short films, they're often more a calling card. But when you're doing a feature, getting it out there, getting the word out to people, it makes such a huge difference. So I could not agree more. And yeah, Karen is fantastic. I'm sure she's going to love hearing this part of the interview, because we normally don't get to talk about her.
I mentioned Karen so many times throughout the course of a year. Karen and I have known each other, I don't even know how many decades now. And she is just first rate, and she loves indie films. She loves festival films. She loves the quirky genre films. She's wonderful, and she does a great job for the filmmakers and gets the word out about the films. And you know, at fest level, that is so important. And even if it's a short film that might just be a calling card for you, so many people doing shorts, they have hopes and expectations of making it into a feature. So a publicist will help you get the short in front of people who might be able to lead you to financing so you can do that feature film. And I've seen it
Absolutely.
Happen many, many times over the past 42 years that I've been doing this as a working critic. But, yeah, I'm so thrilled. I can't wait for everybody to see your film and the others, our other filmmakers who are on today. Now I have to hunt down Miss Murray's film and the publicist on that one because I just think she's just so wonderful in Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox. Now, is there any...
Well, if Tim...
Go ahead.
If Tim Travers made you like Nicole, you're going to love Death Perception because you get 10 times more Nicole.
Oh, my God. Oh, well, I definitely am going to hunt that down. Now, is there anything that you would have done differently with Tim Travers than what...
Yes, I would have had twice as much money.
Okay, well...
I would have had 10 times as much money.
Irrespective of money.
I would have paid myself better.
Wait, you paid yourself? You got paid?
Yes, by me, so it doesn't really count.
No, that doesn't really count, Stimson. That doesn't count.
You got to satisfy those union contracts, even when you're a union contract to hire yourself.
Oh, my God. No, I'm curious if there's anything outside of budgetary constraints. Is there anything that you would have done differently in achieving the final product that you have? Because I think what you have is brilliant.
You know, it kind of goes back to that budgetary thing, but this time being a little less facetious. Mm-hmm. I wish we had had the means to simply have more time. I am very proud that we made this film in only 17 days, and I think it's a beast of a production to have knocked out in 17 days.
Yeah.
People will be shocked when they watch it. But the product we made made me so happy that a lot of the times I have to just wonder what could I have done if we'd had those additional days to prep and rehearse, if everything had been a little more relaxed on set, what additional nuances we could have found. It's one of those, it's hard to know without having been there what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have is something we're all very proud of. But it was truly just a flying by the seat of our pants production. Like, it just truly one of those, we never knew what we were going to be shooting 2 hours from now, let alone 2 days from now. I remember Brian and I are very careful shot listers. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll storyboard if I have the time because I like to give very clear instructions. This was one where I think we made it to the third day of production before we both threw our hands up in the air and said, well, no shot list, no storyboards. We're just going to wing it because it's the only way to do it in the time frame we have.
Oh, my God. And, of course, if people are wondering, and I'm sure they are, it's like a film about scientists, science, time travel. Yes, the song, the top 40 song that you would expect to be in this film is in this film.
Yes, it is. And I was amazed
that you got it.
Yes.
We
had to show them the scene to get permission. Like, we actually
really?
Had to show, oh yeah, and I can't talk about the scene, but you know the scene. We did have to show that to them. I was shocked they said yes to letting us use it.
That, because, dare I even ask, did it cost half your budget to get the rights to the song?
I can neither confirm nor deny what it cost, but it was actually quite reasonable.
Oh, okay.
The song owners and Thomas Dolby are actually very easy people to work with a good sense of humor.
Okay.
I mean, there's a fair amount of paperwork involved in that sort of thing,
yeah.
But that was one of the comparatively less dramatic parts of the process.
Wow.
It was just kind of going through the proper channels, doing the paperwork, making sure everybody liked what was happening creatively. Sometimes the system does work.
It does. But as I'm sure you know, there are so many filmmakers and there are dream songs that they want. And it's, I want this, I want this. But it truly, I'm not exaggerating here, but the licensing cost of one song it has come back to some filmmakers and producers, well, it's 50% of the budget. So,
oh, and one of the things that will happen to a lot of filmmakers, and a trap which never, ever falls. So advice to any filmmaker, especially on the indie scene who wants to use a song, always make sure the end rates are negotiated in the original contract. Sometimes people will license it just to a festival, and then they'll get offer a big sale, but they haven't determined what the price will be to use the song in wide release.
Yep.
So that's just part of having good contract negotiators, but always, always make sure you have that covered up front.
Yep. But, oh, job just so well done, Stimson. I can't wait to see what you make next.
Well, you and me both. We'll see. Oh.
Well, you have, it has been so wonderful having you on the show today. I hope you'll come back again in the future. And
anytime. Do I have to have made a film to come back, or can
no.
we just chat sometime?
You don't have to have made a film. Hey, you know, musician Frank Meyer, he's also a director. He's got some documentaries out, directed music videos, records albums with multiple bands. Frank has been here 4 times in studio already. Even when he has nothing to talk about but for being on tour with a band or just movies in general or filmmaking in general. No, people, you don't have to have a film to come back on my show. Unless I don't like you, in which case I won't invite you back. But I have already invited you back, so you know I like you, and I would
I would
welcome you back. But, oh, Stimson, this has been so wonderful having you on the show today. I can't wait to hear how the film is received at Dances with Films. I know it's been well received in other festivals around the country, but this is a biggie. So,
oh, yeah. This is a big LA screening.
Oh, thank you so, so much for being on the show today, Tim. This has been so much fun. And a lot of insightful stuff that you've imparted that will benefit indie filmmakers in particular, of which they make a big part of my audience. So I thank you for that.
Hey, happy to help anytime.
You go have a wonderful rest of your week until premiere day in L.A. at Dances with Films next Tuesday, the 25th. Get your tickets, people. You won't be disappointed. Oh, thank you, Stimson, and hopefully we'll chat sooner rather than later.
Hope to see you at the festival. It'll be great to meet in person.
It will. Thanks so much, Stimson. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Stimson Sneed, writer-director of Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox. 3 great filmmakers on the show today. How did I get so lucky? 3 wonderful films, 2 shorts, 1 feature, Dances with Films. Check it out. You really want to see all of these films and a few more. And now Stimson gave me one I've got to check out with one of the actors from his movie who is in another film with a bigger role. So Dances with Films starts this weekend. Check it out. TCL, Chinese Theater Complex, upstairs in the Theater 6 area. Great venue, good fest. Have fun festing. And until then, if you want to go to the theater and see films, number one, check out The Grab. Gabriella Cowperthwaite's new documentary. It will leave you shell-shocked. You think what she did with Blackfish was shocking? Where do you see The Grab? Then Firebrand just opened in theaters on Friday, starring Jude Law, Alicia Vikander, and it is the story of Catherine Parr, a chapter in her life. She was the one wife of Henry VIII who he didn't kill. It's a glorious, glorious film. The performances are amazing. Jude Law is unrecognizable. Just on every level, production values are superb. And then coming out this Friday, Thelma, everybody I know is waiting for Thelma, June Squibb, 94-year-old action hero, as well as The Exorcism with Russell Crowe. It will scare the bejeebus out of you. But that's all the time we have today. And of course, we ran over as always. So until next week, where we're going to have more filmmakers, more Dances with Films films. I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.